Preventable medical errors remain a serious problem more than a decade after the landmark report by the Institute of Medicine sounded the alarm. While it's difficult to ascertain how many are killed by medical mistakes each year in the United States, estimates range into the hundreds of thousands. According to the journal Health Affairs, medical errors cost the nation $17 billion every year. In just a moment, Dr. Berlinger, or Nancy as she prefers, is going to talk to us about the role of forgiveness in this multifactorial problem. But first, let me tell you a little bit about her. Nancy is a research scholar at the Hastings Center, a nonpartisan research institution that's been around since 1969 and is dedicated to bioethics and the public interest. Nancy focuses her teaching and research on ethical issues in the organization and delivery of healthcare, ethics policy in human rights and in public health contexts, and patient safety. She co-directs a research project on ethics and policy issues in the care of undocumented immigrants in the United States healthcare system. Nancy is the director of the first revision of the Hastings Center's landmark ethics guidelines on end-of-life care. And she is, of course, the author of After Harm, Medical Error and the Ethics of Forgiveness, which she will sign after the presentation and which can be purchased in the lobby. Nancy has a special interest in ethics and policy concerning the management of cancer as a chronic illness. She teaches a graduate seminar in healthcare ethics at the Yale School of Nursing and lectures frequently in medical schools and healthcare institutions in the United States and internationally. In fact, we met at a meeting in New Zealand this past summer. She is a graduate of Smith College and holds a doctorate from the University of Glasgow and an MDiv from Union Theological Seminary. Please help me welcome Nancy.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Now I'm mic'd up properly. I'm so honored to be here today in my favorite city in Texas, and I know you have a lot of cities, with my very favorite Texas lawyer, Lee Taft. It was my honor and pleasure to spend the afternoon working with him. So when Dr. Bergman and Dr. Klugman called me a few months ago and asked me to come give a talk, I said, I should tell you, by way of full disclosure, not the financial part. I never have anything exciting to disclose there. But I actually gave an earlier version of this talk in San Antonio, and they said, how long ago was it? And I said, well, it was 2008. And they said, oh, long enough. You know, that's okay. So they assured me the topic was still relevant, and indeed it's a perennial topic. But for those of you who may have been in that audience, I want to reassure you that there's some new material, and there is corrected Hebrew. So thank you, Craig Klugman, for that, for saving me from my own lack of Hebrew. So I thought before we plunge into our topic, and I hope this will be interactive if I'm unclear during the performance or if I talk too quickly because I am from New York, please make some sign of desperation and I'll calm down. But also I hope afterwards there'll be questions and discussion because I'm not a clinician and I know that many of you are, so you've faced this in a way that I have not. But I thought I might start by telling you how I got interested in the connection between error and forgiveness or in the ethics of forgiveness. Many years ago, a dear friend of mine, a friend from college, told me that she was leaving her husband. She had very young children because her husband had been abusing her. And a friend who was a clergyman, her minister and his wife, had literally helped her to escape a very difficult situation, and they had sheltered her and helped her get to safety. And she said, you know, I'm in a difficult, I have a question for you because my minister has said you have to forgive your husband. And she said, I want to know, do I have to? And my first impulse was to say, well, of course you don't, you know, because I was her friend and I was very angry with him. But she said, no, I really want to know, as a Christian, as a person who tries to be ethical, is it that my job to forgive him? He's never acknowledged what he's done. He still hasn't. He's never made any gesture toward anything that I could respond to. I remember she said, it's like talking to a wall. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do. And I said, well, you know, let me look into it, you know, sort of scholarly approach. And my friend is trained as a scholar, so this is what she was asking for, that kind of answer. And And I was studying the work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer at the time, who some of you may know. He was a Christian theologian of the Nazi era, and his entire professional life coincided with the years of the Nazi regime. He was a member of the resistance. He was executed at the very end of the war. And he wrote a book. He figured out what the Nazis were onto quite early. His father was a medical professor, and very early on, he was clear about what was going on with policies being directed toward people who were mentally handicapped and racial minorities, and then gearing up for the final solution. And he even involved his father in that and said, you know, let's try to help our friends who are running different kinds of what would be sort of communities for the disabled, because they're being put under this terrible pressure that we're still trying to understand what they're being asked to do. But very early on, he wrote a book, Conscious of the Censorship, and that he was going to be under. So it's written in theological language, but he talks about something that he calls cheap grace. And he was conscious of the fact that the church was being co-opted very, very quickly. And he said, you know, we're being pressured into giving away something that we should hold very dear. And he said, when we do that, we knock down something into something cheap. He calls it like bargain basement goods. And so this is what when he was talking about forgiveness, he said forgiveness should not be held cheaply. We should say that this is something valuable. So, you know, that was in my mind. And then I was at the Hastings Center, and I started to work on medical error. And some of these strands started coming together, the personal story, the theological story, and then this very practical story of efforts to deal not only with the problem of medical error as a healthcare problem, as an ethical problem, but what do you do when someone is actually harmed? So that's our question for this evening is, what ought to happen after one person harms the person that they were trying to help? It's sort of the anthropologist or the sociologist question. Now, physicians and other healthcare professionals may wonder if the answer to this question includes the word forgiveness, and patients and families may wonder about that too. So let me see if I can advance my slide. Ah, I have to pull out my little drawer. Okay, here we go. Okay, so this was from a study that came out in JAMA 10 years ago, so shortly after the study that Craig mentioned, a focus group study of academic and community physicians. And it reported that physicians experienced powerful emotions following a medical error and felt upset and guilty about harming the patient. They struggled to find support finding a medical error. And for many physicians, they reported the most difficult challenge was forgiving themselves for the error. This was in a focus group, so they were responding at length. In the opinion of one participant, he said, forgiveness is something that I think is tougher for the physicians to give themselves than to get from the patient. And the study's authors concluded that the notion of a blame-free culture of errors, and sometimes you see that as sort of a slogan, did not diminish their sense of anguish and culpability. And the investigators concluded that better institutional support for caregivers involved in errors would help them to focus their attention on the affected patient. And I think those of you who were at the workshops this afternoon, that was something that Lee and colleagues were focusing on, the idea that how do you support the person so that person can focus on the patient? You don't bypass the patient and just focus on the doctor, the nurse, whomever, but you don't just leave them out and say, well, you know, better you than me, pal, and I hope it all works out for you in court. So a recent book co-authored by Tom Gallagher at the University of Washington, who was one of the co-authors of this study, It's a wonderful book that's called Talking with Patients and Families About Medical Error. It's very, very practical. It's out from Hopkins. It's probably in paperback now. And in it, they write, deciding how to share the facts of the situation and avoid speculation while simultaneously managing feelings of guilt, the urge to assign blame, and the desire to protect oneself is, as they say, hardly an easy task. All of these things going on at once in real time. So we see just with these brief snapshots, and there's many other studies, many of them conducted by the Gallagher team, Gallagher and colleagues, making mistakes, thinking about our mistakes, churns up a lot of emotion, anguish, guilt, fear, not emotions you want to be part of your everyday life. Where does ethics come into this mix? And why may forgiveness be an ethical issue for physicians and patients? So let's look at ethics for a moment. Ethics, including medical ethics, always has a social dimension. We're not so much talking about the perfect informed consent form, the perfect IRB, something like that. That's sort of downstream regulatory kinds of forms of ethics. But we can be, there's a wonderful essay by William James that I urge you to go and find. It's called The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life. And in it, James says, you know, imagine a person alone on an island. That person can be moral all by himself or herself. They can just think things through. They're in a room by themselves, and they can say, these are my values. This is what I think is good and evil. Add one other person to that island, and it becomes an ethical situation. It becomes a moral universe. And he said it would be a tragic universe because they would die because they're on an island with no food. But for as long as there's two people, there's going to be some interesting tension going on because they're not going to be clones of one another. So when we talk about ethics, we talk about there being a social dimension. We often talk about it being other-directed. We talk about it being something that is exhibited through one's behaviors, not just through one's private thoughts. We're ethical or unethical once we start doing things that affect other people. So the values expressed in a familiar principle such as do no harm with the idea of to someone else concerns our actions with respect to persons and things other than ourselves, in particular with respect to people who are sick. So ethics is more than rules of professional conduct, the idea of a code of ethics, for example, though obviously that's important. It involves close attention to the emotions present in an ethically challenging situation, one's own emotions, the emotions of another person. In the aftermath of medical harm, ethical practice includes the care of injured patients and their families through practices such as truth-telling, apology, and fair compensation. These practices are likely to involve a physician responsible for the patient's care at the time of the injury, or even the physician who's involved in the care right now, even if the error is attributable to some other source. They may involve other professionals and administrators as well. Fair compensation, for example, will usually require collaboration between a physician and a risk manager. So a large literature on the psychological impact of caring for patients in general suggests that physicians' emotions concerning different types of bad outcomes, such as the experience of being fired by a patient or family, should be recognized. And I'm going to talk about that later because there's some interesting parallels with situations that may not be clear-cut harm, but the physician may still feel like I've done something wrong here. The physician whose self-confidence has been shaken by one case is still being relied on to provide care to other patients. The ethical dimensions of medical harm, therefore, include how the involved physician recovers from such incidents. And this recovery may involve the desire for forgiveness. Forgiveness is a word that has two contradictory meanings, those of you who remember your Greek mythology. It's what's called a Janus word. It's got two faces, like January, the first month of the year. We're accustomed to forgiving family members and friends after minor or major arguments. You sort of agree to get along until next Thanksgiving. And in these cases, forgiveness is understood to mean reconciliation. You'll get along until you're not getting along. However, we may also forgive a loan to a family member. The library may forgive our fines to encourage us to return those books we borrowed, you know, decades ago. And in those cases, forgiveness is understood to mean detachment, a cancellation, an end to an obligation between parties. When we speak about forgiveness after medical harm, which kind of forgiveness do we mean? The kind that brings people together, or the kind that allows them to detach from each other and go their separate ways? These are important questions because medical harm occurs in different types of healthcare relationships. How does forgiveness work in the relationship between a patient and a primary care physician who may have a long-standing relationship? How does it work in the relationship between a hospitalized patient and the different members of a healthcare team, or between a patient and a specialist who may not have had much of a relationship at all? How do you forgive a system for a system's error? That language can seem very, very accurate and also very cold or unfamiliar at the same time. And what about self-forgiveness? Does that even count? We're going to talk about that later. But let's start by looking at some of the sources of our ideas about forgiveness. How a culture frames the human potential for error can influence how a person shaped in some way by that culture thinks about forgiveness as a possible response to human error. Here's my Hebrew. So, for example, in the Hebrew Bible, the word chata appears 595 times, more than four times as often as its nearest synonym. This word for error has often been translated as sin, especially by Christian sources. But a more accurate translation would be to miss the mark, like an archer who takes aim at a target and misses, or a traveler who knows the road that they're going on but misses the correct turn, or a physician who orders the wrong drug, knowing the right drug, the pharmacist or the nurse who doesn't catch the mistake in the order, even though they know the right dosage. The knowledge is there, the skill is there, the intent is there, the action doesn't go as planned. The experience of making a medical mistake can feel like the experience of missing the mark. It could have gone the other way, and indeed, most of the time, it does. However, the same incident of missing the mark, for example, a harmful medication error, may be framed as a technical error by the culture of medicine, a potential claim by risk management, a system failure by patient safety, an injury with medical, financial, and psychological consequences by the harmed patient or that patient's family, and a psychologically and professionally traumatic event by the individual clinicians involved. That's one missing the mark. All of these things could be going on. By appreciating the different ways in which the same incident can be framed, we can see how the expectations of each party concerning the resolution of some such cases are likely to differ rather dramatically. So how does the harmed party, who may be the patient, who may be the family, in the case of the patient's death, or could be a combination, forgive the person or system that has missed the mark, resulting in harm? Jewish traditions concerning forgiveness emphasize concrete interpersonal obligations. Kapara, a Hebrew word associated with rituals of atonement, refers to the reconciliation of the person who has committed an error with the person he or she has injured. And these rituals are enacted by observant Jews each year prior to Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And Kippur and Kapara are related as words. So, in a very simple chart, one might say that once there is an error, and this would be in both the Jewish tradition and in the Christian traditions that closely follow on it and are related to it, forgiveness is a response to two discrete actions or series of actions, an acknowledgement of the error by the person who has made it, a practice that sometimes is called confession, and an effort by this person to make amends for the harm he or she has done, the practice or practices that might be called repentance or atonement. Forgiveness is the outcome of this relational process. So with respect to medical harm, you would see truth-telling and apology as your medical versions of confession. For repentance and atonement, the parallels would be compensation, quality improvement programs, and so on. But they might be a number of different activities. These lay the conditions for forgiveness. They don't trigger it. They don't make it an automatic process. So in medicine, this process is set in motion by the discovery that what has happened should not have happened, that an error, in fact, occurred, not just, you know, bad outcomes sort of floating around, but the fact that there was a mistake. Truth-telling and apology and fair compensation and analyzing and changing how we work through quality improvement are all things that have entered, you know, medical culture at least in the past 10 years since To Err is Human. Actually, that came out in 1999. So it's nearly 15 years, and there were people working on this for decades before. But we're familiar with some of these. But this is an ongoing task because of the constant potential for risk in medicine. Now, Jewish and Christian traditions around error and forgiveness are powerful, but not always acknowledged influences on Western culture and Western medicine. Some of you may be familiar with the book Forgive and Remember by Charles Bosk. It was a classic study of surgical residents and their mortality and morbidity conference, M&M. And it's clear that the rituals that he's describing as a sociologist and that people are the language that they're using are based in religious sources that the surgeons in the room may not have been aware of, but they talk about well, you confess, you put on the hair shirt, which is associated with, you know, medieval and earlier practices of atonement. You put on the hair shirt, and that's how you describe what happened in front of everyone. You repent through being given assigned tasks. You're supervised very closely. And then you're forgiven by a senior surgeon who functions as pretty much God, high priest, judge, pastor, peer group representative, and injured party all in one. So you see a lot of interesting sources there. Now, who's excluded from this forgiveness ritual, this particular forgiveness ritual? The patient, exactly. The patient or the loved ones of the deceased patient. Yet patients and families also have ritual needs and expectations in the aftermath of medical harm. They may have been influenced by the same norms. A well-designed disclosure process should always take these needs and expectations into account and should learn how to do so by talking with patients and families about their experiences, good or bad. You know, what did we do for you? Could we have done more? In the Jewish and Christian biblical traditions, the deepest meaning of the word forgiveness is detachment, the idea of not being bound by error. The metaphor associated with forgiveness is the cancellation of a financial debt that can never be repaid and reflects a culture in which debt servitude was common. Those of you who are familiar with the Lord's Prayer might remember, you know, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those. If you look at the Greek, the language is about releasing people from debt. It's all debts and debtors. But the idea of forgiveness as reconciliation may also be associated with religion, the idea that, you know, that you should forgive and forget, ideas like that. And patients and healthcare professionals may base their ideas about what good people, what moral people are supposed to do after one person harms another on lessons they learned as children, whether these lessons were conveyed in terms of religious beliefs and practices or simply as good manners. You mess up, you fess up, or, you know, stop hitting your brother and say you're sorry, things like that. In the aftermath of medical harm, individuals who hold these values may be unsure whether their goal should be the reconciliation of persons. Becoming free from the error itself as a source of continuing suffering may be an appropriate goal, whether or not individual persons wish to be reconciled. So a patient, or let's say the widow of someone who has died, may never want to see the surgeon who she holds responsible again, but she also would like her life not to be shaped solely by this disaster that happened in the middle of it. So there's more than one thing going on. So we've assumed that the whole goal is to get people to play nicely. We may be missing what the person who's harmed actually is telling us that they want. Also, influential traditions are not universal norms. Not everyone uses the same metaphors or thinks about human relationships the same way. For example, forgiveness as a metaphor for a relationship between individuals may not make sense in religious traditions such as Hinduism or Buddhism, in which a concept of the self as independent from other persons is not the norm. When I was working on this book, I was talking with a Japanese Buddhist cardiologist who happened to be a visiting scholar at the Hastings Center. And she said, you know, it's really hard when you're practicing Buddhist and someone hurts you. And I said, why is that? She said, well, we believe that suffering is an inevitable feature of life, and we believe that everyone is connected. So the idea is that if someone harms you, that you are, the idea is that they're suffering too because you're connected to one another. But she said, it's a problem if they don't seem like they're suffering. You know, so she said, don't imagine that Buddhism has the magical solution. We struggle with this as much as we can. In a culturally diverse society like the United States, where the physician population and the patient population may have been shaped by a variety of religious and other cultural experiences, we should recognize that the sources of medicine's common metaphors and expectations concerning error and forgiveness may derive from a variety of sources. Everyone doesn't have the same grandmother. We weren't all shaped in the same way. So let's consider for a moment whether forgiveness is good for us, as there are many popular articles that suggest this. Research by some clinical psychologists and social scientists suggests that the ability to forgive may be characteristic of an emotionally healthy person. While a refusal to forgive may be associated with behaviors ranging from holding grudges to perpetuating civil wars. Other scholars and clinicians, however, have criticized efforts to prescribe forgiveness as a therapeutic intervention, arguing that these efforts fail to recognize forgiveness as an individual's personal response to the experience of being harmed. As legal scholar and Harvard Law School Dean Martha Minow points out, fundamentally, forgiveness cannot be commanded, because then you are constraining a person's freedom. This body of empirical research does not as yet address forgiveness after medical harm directly, so these findings cannot be applied directly to our situation. However, the idea that forgiveness is good for people is a very attractive idea in our culture. I remember being at the dentist and looking at the pile of magazines that they have there, and the May 2011 issue of Oprah, of O Magazine, featured an article entitled, How to Forgive Anyone and Why Your Health Depends on It. And, you know, so this is just something that you're told you have to do, that you shouldn't hold on to things like this. So, you know, that's part of the you know, the burden that people can walk around with. Am I an unforgiving person, an unhealthy person, because I cannot forgive someone? So that's just something else to keep in mind. So let's try out some of these ideas and see whether they work in a context in which someone who expected to be helped, a patient, has been harmed. Now, right away, there's a problem. If we identify forgiveness as a characteristic of an emotionally healthy person, does that mean that an injured patient is an unhealthy person who is willfully holding a grudge if he or she does not offer forgiveness? The frequent characterization of harmed patients as angry patients, as angry people, angry families, reflects a still common failure to acknowledge two things: that anger is an appropriate response to this situation, and that the person who is accountable for making things right after harm is not the same as the person who has been harmed. That responsibility lies elsewhere. This confusion also plays out at the organizational level, when a hospital characterizes itself as blame-free but fails to explain how this helps patients. Will this new culture dismiss patients and families who seek explanations or compensation for harm as troublemakers who are looking for someone to blame? I've done ethics education with risk managers, and I've always been troubled when you do a case study like the ones we were doing this afternoon, and someone says something like, "Well, you know, there's that family opened that can of worms." And like, by asking what happened, or in some cases by bringing a lawyer into the proceedings, I said, were they offered any other way to go about it? Well, no. But the stigma is attached to them very, very quickly. And so that's something one always has to be aware of, especially in medical education, because it can be in the water supply sometimes. You know, the idea that, well, you have to be careful about juries, you have to be careful about those families, and so on and on. And it's always important to ask, tell me what your experience is of these families and these juries. And sometimes the person hasn't had any, but they've heard stories. So there's a further problem with prescribing forgiveness broadly as an intervention. As human beings, we may be reluctant to say, "I forgive you," if we believe that we are merely excusing bad behavior rather than responding to changed behavior. Psychologists call the pressure to offer forgiveness prematurely pseudo-forgiveness, and we know what Dietrich Bonhoeffer would call it, cheap grace. Some have suggested that therapeutic interventions that aim to produce forgiveness are unsound because they put so much responsibility on the harmed party, and that person is also the less powerful party. So there's this injustice that can be perpetuated in these situations. Often this comes up in cases involving abuse, as in the example I used earlier, and why sometimes mediation approaches that assume equality among persons fail to notice that there's the major power imbalances in relationships. And the patient who feels pressured to offer forgiveness or closure, for example, prematurely may indeed get angry and may file a lawsuit. So one has to be very attuned to what the expectations, what one is hoping to get out of a situation may be very different from what the patient is telling you that they need. So the discovery of a mistake leads directly to the words, "I'm sorry." It can lead directly to those words. But the words, "I'm sorry," do not lead directly to the words, "I forgive you," because this is not solely a matter of the right words. So what about self-forgiveness? Let's look at that. Forgiving oneself for harming a patient is not at all the same thing as making it possible for this patient to choose to offer you forgiveness. However, a physician who through his or her actions supports the ability of a patient to forgive through disclosure, through apology, through helping with fair compensation, also may need to practice self-forgiveness so he or she is able to get back to work, is able not to doubt themselves. What does self-forgiveness mean beyond an intuitive sense of wanting to be free of the burden of guilt? Philosopher Charles Griswold at Boston University rightly distinguishes between forgiveness, which can be granted only by the injured party, and self-forgiveness. In self-forgiveness, according to Griswold, the injury that one has done to oneself precisely in injuring another is the catalyst for confessing to oneself, "This is what I did." So if the discovery of the mistake leads to the words, "I'm sorry," the discovery of the harmful mistake also initiates a parallel process that can lead to self-forgiveness as the physician grapples with the blow of having harmed a patient. You've got to get right with the patient, and you've got to get right with yourself, but they're not the same thing. Now, Another philosopher who's looked at this is Jeff Bluestein, and this is a wonderful article on taking responsibility for one's past. He argues that self-forgiveness, like forgiveness, is a feature of taking responsibility for one's past, which is sort of like saying it's a way of being a mature person. In Bluestein's view, the past is not simply a checklist of what we did and what we failed to do, but should be viewed in psychological and narrative terms. What one has shown oneself to be like by what one has done. Our own past, as we understand it, is something that ought to be accessible and useful to us. Physicians, for example, are accustomed to drawing on years of clinical training and experience. If we are unable to forgive ourselves for something in our past, something we didn't learn properly or something we didn't do properly, there's going to be a break in our story of ourselves as we know it. We're going to have difficulty understanding the content of our own character. We may have difficulty anticipating how well we will respond to a similar situation in the future. And he also reminds us that any genuine process of forgiveness is not automatic. Self-forgiveness, like forgiveness of others, is ordinarily a process that has to be gone through. It takes time and often not a little effort to suppress or forego one's self-directed negative feelings, the self-hatred. One cannot forgive oneself for what one has done if one is not prepared to take responsibility for it. And the explanation of the failure to take responsibility for some problematic part of one's past might be that one cannot or will not forgive oneself for it. That's just something that you just put in that closet and you don't look at it, but it's going to keep coming back. So what do we make of this tough-minded philosophical account? And I should say, Jeff also used to be a medical ethicist, so he's done a lot of time in hospitals. On the one hand, a person who is not self-forgiving is refusing to acknowledge his or her own human fallibility, or else views himself or herself as a moral monster, irredeemably flawed, beyond the pale. Neither of these is a trustworthy position from which to move forward and help others, something physicians must be able to do. But on the other hand, reducing self-forgiveness to a sort of a refrigerator magnet affirmation, it's a new day, turn the page, love yourself, something like that, would mean the physician is skipping the hard work of figuring out what exactly he or she is on the hook for. And that doesn't bode well for the safety of future patients. And this could, I keep saying physician, but we could mean, be referring to nurses, pharmacists, anyone who's capable of being part of a harmful error. And if we're human, we've probably grappled with these questions in another format. So the process of self-forgiveness is likely to be a messy one inherently, as the physician grapples with his or her own emotions, the sense of responsibility concerning his or her actions, and also perhaps with emotions directed toward others who are involved in the error. Why didn't that pharmacist catch the mistake in my order? Why didn't that nurse stand up to me if she noticed the mistake? Do they share responsibility for this harm, or is it all on me? Would I have listened to them or just said, dismiss them? And how can I talk with them about this so we can continue to work together, mindful of the fact that in the hierarchy, I'm more powerful than they are? So in the same essay, Jeff Bluestein writes that self-reproach makes sense only for something over which we had self-control. So this introduces another philosophical idea, which is moral luck. To what extent should we be praised or blamed for things that just happen? Separating one's emotional response to a distressing situation, what happened to that patient was terrible, from one's actions, what was my role in what happened to that patient, involves reflection on these questions. Do I feel bad about this situation because it's inherently tragic? Or do I feel bad because I had an opportunity to do some specific good or prevent some specific harm and I blew it? Or maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. Self-forgiveness can be especially complicated when it's not clear that a patient has been harmed by a clinician's action or inaction, but there's a sense that things could have gone better. In a wonderful 2007 article called On Being Fired, four specialists in the care of dying patients, palliative medicine specialists, argue that in their specialty, clinicians may be at greater risk than other medical clinicians of being rejected by patients. The patient who is referred to palliative care late in the course of a terminal disease is often psychologically distressed and physically exhausted. They may reject the offer to build a relationship with yet another physician and team. Or the patient may initially accept palliative care, but then project his or her own distress onto palliative care professionals, breaking off relations because you're always making me feel bad, you always want to talk about death. Some patients may fire palliative care, just say, I don't want you people in my room anymore, as a means of asserting some control, as they write, pushing us away allows the patient to feel less close to death. Now, being fired is personally painful and can induce feelings of guilt and shame. As the fired professional wonders, how can this have happened to me? Am I any good at this work or not? What do my colleagues think of me now? The professional may struggle to figure out how much of the situation was under his or her control. Should I have gone in with a better communication strategy? Should I have, you know, sat down in a different way, worn a different tie? I mean, you know, what was it? What was wrong with my performance? Talking things over with colleagues who are familiar with the psychology of suffering and dying may help this colleague to understand his or her own feelings and also figure out if there were missed opportunities. Is this just part of the job, or did I make a mistake in how I sought to help that patient? So it isn't always a medication error, a missed decimal point, a slip of a scalpel, a bad handoff. It can also be these subtle communication mistakes that have to be unpacked regularly in some professions. Figuring out what an individual clinician controls is complicated because medical mistakes, as we know, as we've heard so many times, happen inside of complex systems. Richard Cook, an anesthesiologist who studies systems such as healthcare that are intrinsically hazardous and possess potential for catastrophic failure, points out that working in such a system requires intimate contact with failure. That is, the physician or other worker should be able to imagine how a tolerably safe situation, what he and others call the envelope, can slip into an unsafe situation, and how their actions move performance towards or away from the edge of that envelope. He has a wonderful website called ctlab.org. It's out of the University of Chicago, and he's got all sorts of wonderful articles, and it's definitely worth a look if you're at all interested in this. So what should physicians do in the aftermath of medical harm with respect to forgiveness, given all of these things that are floating around? What helps the injured party, and what helps the physician to recover from this incident? Well, first, the physician should not expect to hear the words, I forgive you, from a patient or family, even after disclosure, apology, and assistance in securing fair compensation, if that is part of a just resolution of the harm. Asking for forgiveness may be oppressive to a patient or family still grappling with the fact of the harm, the impact of the harm, and their own emotional responses to the harm. Asking them during a time of crisis or even bereavement to offer a premature formulaic response is simply too much to ask. It's sort of trying to force cheap grace. The process of forgiveness may be the work of months or years or decades on their part. At the same time, however, the physician can work towards self-forgiveness by taking responsibility for his or her past, by working to understand his or her role in an incident that slipped beyond the envelope of safety, and by responding to the needs that have been created as the result of harm. If we value forgiveness, we truly value this as a desirable and authentically human response to human error in medicine and in human life, we must create the conditions that will help those who have been harmed to offer forgiveness, and in so doing, we must also help those whose actions have caused harm to be restored as healers. And I want to wrap this up before our discussion with two memories. When I gave that earlier version of this talk in San Antonio in November 2008, it was the morning of Election Day. It was a big day, so very exciting. I took a walk downtown along the Riverwalk and into Southtown. And it was during the Days of the Dead Festival, and I came across something that completely blew my mind as a New Yorker. I came across Ofrendas. They were so amazing, the altars with offerings to dead loved ones. On one altar, there was a can of hairspray for somebody's mother. This is what she needed. In another, at the Ursuline School, that's part of the arts college, there was a bowl of kibble for the cat that had lived at the school. The cat's name was Callie. And I began to think, as I was thinking about the talk that I was going to be giving, that talking about medical mistakes openly, often in the aftermath of a tragedy affecting a specific person, a specific person's loved one, are a kind of ofrenda. They're a kind of offering to the dead. They often have a photograph of the person in the room. As rituals of mourning and commemoration, in addition to opportunities for learning and innovation, which is often how we talk about them, and I think it's important that we always keep that human story and that connection to real lives, the absence of that person, in mind. And one last memory. I once gave a very early version of this talk when I was writing the book at a medical grand rounds at a hospital in Pennsylvania. And at that hospital, grand rounds are at noon, so instead of being asleep first thing in the morning, the residents were all eating lunch, so the room was like filled with the smell of food. And after the discussion, one of the residents came bounding down the aisle, and he said, "I had Chinese for lunch. This was in my fortune cookie. I want you to have it." So you can see the soy sauce on one side. So I had it made into my little slide. So sweet, huh? And to think he's probably like an attending now. In very small type, but you may be able to have a chance to look at the slides, are some further reading. There's an article I did, a short version of this, for Virtual Mentor, which is on the web. That's the AMA's journal, and a number of the other sources, but most of the others are ones that I mentioned on the slides. And just a little preview, as Craig mentioned, the Hastings Center guidelines for decisions on life-sustaining treatment and care near the end of life is coming out on May 7th. And the first edition was in 1987, so only 26 years between editions. So I hope if you work in the field of end-of-life care at all, you have occasion to take a look at that someday in printed ebook. So thank you very, very much, and I hope that we can have some discussion. Thank you.
So we have time for question and answer now. We have microphones that are coming, can come around the room if somebody has a question.
Okay, you've discussed the very great time depth of religious origins of some of these concepts, forgiveness, reconciliation, that have come from, you know, tens of thousands of years back probably as major social and cultural organizers. But religion also gives us another concept, a broad concept, a social concept of infallibility. Mm-hmm. So how do we address that, particularly as it applies to healing?
The concept of our own fallibility.
Well, of infallibility.
Oh, of infallibility. Oh, well, that's very interesting. But of humans as infallible?
No. But the thing that we emulate is being infallible. And therefore, we influence the tech. You know, so many people say, well, you're playing God. And in many cases, we are.
You know, that's very interesting because, and I would imagine that's something, especially as medical educators, whether you're doing it formally or you're doing it as a mentor, a role model, how do you build up the nerve, the hubris that people need to do certain kinds of medical procedures, like in surgery, for example? You have to imagine that you're not going to get it wrong, you know, and yet at the same time say, oh, but you know you're fallible and fragile, and you know, and things like that. Or there's in one of the books that I said in my book by Sandra Gilbert, who wrote about her husband's death in the aftermath of successful surgery for prostate cancer, but he died in post-op. She said before the surgery, the surgeon was literally holding out his hands and saying, "These hands will save him. You know, you can trust these hands." And she and her husband were like, "Wow, we're in good hands." You know, and then afterwards, you know, he was like, "I don't know what happened. But the surgery was a success." And it was. He kept. And she writes about this book. He kept calling her up and saying, "You know, we got the pathology back, and it was a good thing you went with that surgery." And she said, "But he's dead." You know, and so it was deeply confusing to her and very, very distressing. So I don't know how you can deal with this except directly. I remember I used that you know, some of the things that her surgeon had said. I was giving a talk in a narrative medicine program. So there, you know, I was working with these first person stories, and I remember this resident said to me, he put up his hand and he just said, "Well, you're not a surgeon. Things can go wrong. You don't know what happens." But then he said, "Oh, but I can't believe he said that to her." And so it was both. It was the idea of things just happen sometimes, but I certainly don't want to be a jerk when I talk about it. You know, there was this human side of there's a right way and a wrong way to talk with someone. I guess you have to acknowledge it directly and say, you know, if you're talking all the time about how you're fallible and make mistakes, it's hard to imagine that someone's going to place a lot of trust in you with a very delicate sort of a treatment. But on the other hand, if one starts to believe that one will never make a mistake, again, I don't know that many early career physicians. When I eavesdrop on medical students or early career doctors, they talk about you never forget your first one. They expect that this will happen to them. They do wonder how they're going to be prepared to deal with it.
So my question is about harm that isn't accidental, mm-hmm. but neither desired, mm-hmm. but rather instrumental. Everything we use is poisonous, unpleasant. Nobody likes to be in the hospital. Much of what we do is harmful by its nature. So there are new harms introduced with chemotherapy, dialysis, mm-hmm. Chest compressions. Mm-hmm. And yet, as clinicians, we're compelled to offer and deliver these things to people. So even when there's not an accidental outcome where a person might say, I'm sorry this happened, I didn't mean it. There are many cases where I did mean it, and I'm still sorry. So how might the ethics of forgiveness work when it's not an accident, but it's part and parcel of what you do as a provider?
Well, that's interesting because I think one, and this is something, you know, it's interesting, this came up with respect to the guidelines. We talk a lot about, constantly we talk about benefits and burdens of treatment. And certainly chemotherapy is always burdensome. And the goal is to get the benefits ahead of the burdens because no one would sign up for something that had more burdens than benefits, you know, negligible benefits. Well, no, someone might actually sign up for that, but it's very important that be very, very clear what the benefit is. But I don't know that burdens and harms are the same thing because harm suggests either an intent or some omission or commission that, you know, I think if you do not alert a patient to the burdens of treatment and they experience it, they're surprised by this, that can be experienced by the patient as a harm. I didn't know this was going to put me in the hospital. I didn't know it was going to trash my immune system. I didn't know I couldn't spend time, you know, with my family because I'm so ill. Why didn't you tell me this? So there are ways beyond the physical, I think, that a patient can feel harmed by something. The location of it may be in the communication. The doctor may feel like, but I told you, but there was some lag in the communication. I have difficulty calling a treatment burden a harm. I don't know if others have thoughts about this. I mean, it could be harmful to the person's body, definitely. The toxicity is harmful to the body, but I don't know because that word is so associated with a mistake. I don't know. Do others have thoughts about this?
You know, forgive. There is a malice in that. There is an entitlement that I feel on the part of the forgiver. We are above, you know, you did something bad. I have the right to forgive you or withhold it. It's a power. To me, it's an entitlement. You know, we were God, and the problem here is that doctors are treated like gods, and sometimes they think they're gods, and that is a fallacy, and we need to put us in our place, and I did go to medical school, but it took a lot on my part to accept and reconcile that. Of course, I became a psychiatrist. I didn't become a neurosurgeon, which is a lot easier for me to handle it. But, you know, this forgiveness, I think that we have two victims to our humanity. And it is hard to accept that we're human. We have the victim, the patient that dies or gets hurt, the family that loses the relative, and we have the doctor that made a mistake. Nobody does surgery planning to make a mistake and wanting to make a mistake. And by the sense of calling this a forgiveness, a need to forgiveness, I think I have a picture at home that says, to understand is to forgive even oneself. And that's very hard. It is very hard to hold us to such standards and to forgive us. That's hard enough. And anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I have two short questions. The first one is to, like, so by practicing self-forgiveness, are you saying that, like, the clinicians are going to ignore asking for forgiveness from the other party?
What does self-forgiveness mean to you? And he just said freedom from guilt and self-hatred. And people just kept talking about their, you know, feeling, you know, just in despair about what had happened, just, you know, not wanting to touch someone or thinking they had to leave the profession or something like that. That isn't the patient's problem. They have other problems. But I think as long as we don't conflate them, they may even happen on totally different trajectories. Okay. And you had another question?
Yes, that leads to my second question, is like by practicing self-forgiveness for like repetitively, would that lead to self-pride?
Practicing it, what was the word after self-forgiveness?
Repetitively.
Repeatedly, oh.
Yeah, repeatedly.
Well, I would hope not. I don't know. If the stakes are as high as they would be having harmed a patient, you know, the idea that would be easy to, you know, to, like, especially what Jeff Bluestein says is to take a, I mean, he's really saying hold a mirror up to your past self and say, this is really what happened, and this is really was my role in it. It's not an affirmative, I have to forgive myself, I have to give myself a hug or something. It's saying, I really have to know what happened there, and that's hard. You know, really undertaking that self-examination. And sometimes doctors will say, you know, I'm still thinking about something that happened, and they'll say, on October 23rd, 1985, when I was a resident. I mean, they really are still turning it over in their mind, and their willingness to talk about it is part of how they, perhaps part of their self-forgiveness process, but it's also how they keep it real with students to say, this really did happen to me, and I'm really going to talk with you about it because I can't tell you that you have to face it if you never hear me talk about my own mistakes. Oh, there's someone over there. There's two people over there. The patient person in the back.
Yes, for physicians or surgeons who have asked for forgiveness to the relatives, you know, who have died, and try to compensate, as you have said, you know, for the family, how often do they get sued? You know, what is there, do you have an idea, like, the percentage of these physicians or surgeons who acknowledge that they have made a mistake, they have asked for forgiveness, they have tried to compensate the family of the dead person, how often do they still get sued? I'm just wondering.
Like, I'm going to throw this question to my learned lawyer friend. But I think that the thing that we were talking about is disclosing and apologizing. I doubt there's data on asking for forgiveness right off the bat, but I think that could be itself be perceived as rather oppressive. The idea of, well, and I hope you'll forgive me. And, you know, a family could be saying, you want something from me? You know, I remember that the forgiveness part may come on a very different trajectory. But I think perhaps what you're asking is, what is the relationship between disclosing and apologizing, and whether or not litigation is pursued? And it's not a simple answer. But I think Lee would probably be the best to say a bit about that.
Thanks, Nancy. I think, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at the question. One thing that I think is really interesting is the fact that you remember that Harvard did a study in the early 1990s. Most people who have sustained medical error don't, in fact, initiate a lawsuit. The data then said only about 8% of people who sustain harm as a result of medical error initiate litigation. So there's that piece. The data that has been emerging is fairly thin when we're looking at the conversation Nancy's now having with you in terms of the connection between authentic disclosure and then followed by litigation. There you can look, for instance, at the Lexington VA, which is the ground zero for the disclosure movement. And what the Lexington VA showed after a longitudinal study of being very proactive in their disclosure programs, that the number of claims increased, the aggregate cost of the claims dropped the Lexington VA into the lower quartile of what was being paid. The University of Michigan is another study. They have another longitudinal study. And what they show is that they show that in the wake of full disclosure with a robust transparency and apology, that their claims have dropped in half. I helped Stanford design their system. After about 5 years, Stanford's claims are down by 36%, and they also have this very robust disclosure, and when there is error, coupled with an apology.
Oh, hello. I was given the microphone, so I don't want to take away from what we were just discussing with actual lawsuits coming about in harm cases and that kind of thing. I actually wanted to go back to Dr. Morrow's point that he brought up with harm that we perceive as physicians. I'm Lena Ghosh. I'm an internist, and I also do palliative care in the community, and that I do feel that there are differences between physicians of different disciplines as to if we are actually causing harm to a patient by our interventions. Mm-hmm. And that I actually thought of a particular case in that I was a part of as a palliative care doctor. And this was a patient who had I'll discuss it just very briefly. It's a patient who had a very advanced myeloma and was also an elderly gentleman, like 83, and he was in the hospital and pretty much near active death while he was in the hospital when I saw him. And I had had a discussion with the family about him not being resuscitated in the event of an arrest. And this discussion had not been completely resolved, and the gentleman did undergo a respiratory arrest and then was intubated and put into the intensive care unit. And I actually felt internally very conflicted because I felt that this was a harm that was done to this particular patient in a way that the events in the ICU were not going to change his ultimate demise due to his advanced disease. And that this gentleman was taken off the ventilator after 2 or 3 days and did die within a day. And so I felt that despair that we actually talked about a little bit in terms of how could I have prevented this from happening to this patient, and that the family would have never considered this a harm done to their loved one because this is what they were told would be the step if, you know, your loved one can't breathe, we put this tube in, he goes to the ICU. But I think that our perception of harm as physicians can also be a powerful part of if we can ask ourselves for forgiveness. It may not be actual harm that the patient sees and the family agrees, like this, the medical establishment has done harm to us, but that perception of harm from our own internal viewpoint can be just as powerful in that we have conflicts with internally.
I'm very glad you brought this up because there is a phenomenon that's sometimes called moral distress, the idea that you know what the right thing to do is and you're being forced to do the wrong thing or you're not allowed to do the right thing. And it's often been studied among nurses and residents as a hierarchy problem. Somebody else is telling me I must do X. But I've been struck by some examples that I've heard from very senior physicians who'll ICU chiefs who'll say, I feel like I'm torturing this patient, and yet here's the advance directive that says he wants this, or the patient is competent and he's telling me he wants this. And just there's, you know, something about these interventions, or, you know, I would not I wouldn't choose this for me. I don't think he should choose it. But it doesn't, just knowing that this is someone's choice or a surrogate's decision is not assuaging these feelings. And being in touch with this is hugely important. It's really hard, you know, but, you know, what you do is hard. So I think that is, and it might even, your brain might say, what I'm doing is wrong, a mistake, or this shouldn't be happening. So I think having a way of talking about this is part of what an academic medical center can do for the people at training and the people who work in it. And also because some of these, a person can, I remember learning this from a hospice doctor, a person can be very near death and still be the victim of an error. Something can still go wrong in that person's care, and so one always has to be attentive to this. That's another piece of the picture, and yet it's hard because it might there's no disclosure really. There's no one to talk. As far as everyone else is concerned, you're doing the right thing. I'm glad you brought that up because these things can. I remember a neonatologist who said it can happen, that perception can happen very quickly. It's going along, and then something has changed in the patient's condition, and all of a sudden you feel like you're torturing them. But how do you even talk about that? You know. So, you know, thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, I had a question about the transparency in our society. I mean, we advocate that as a good thing. Yet at the same time, being so transparent, especially if things get into the social media, it seems like the piranhas come out. If someone makes a medical mistake, and even if they try to repent or whatever, as it were, they can be torn apart. I mean, there was a Seattle nurse that committed suicide after making an error in the NICU. And even that case in England a couple of months ago was horrible. And, you know, certainly there must have been other problems, but I'd like you to address the social media issue, transparency, and all the complications that keep this from being a, quote, pure process.
Oh, that's a very good point. When To Err Is Human came out, I don't think anyone except maybe the person who was coming up with Twitter had ever heard of it, or, you know, Facebook wasn't nearly as prominent. And so this is, we're in a different and ever-changing world on that front. And yes, if a nurse who was caring for the wife of the heir to the British throne or the grandson can kill herself because there was a practical joke and somebody called and she answered it and, you know, and this poor woman. This is something, again, that is discussed frequently. In other words, should you friend your patients? What do you do if your patients friend you? Should you blog about your patients? What if they blog about you? And so on and on. I don't know that there's going to be a simple answer. I think maybe risk management will tell you, never talk to anybody about anything, but, well, I don't want to be a caricature, but, and someone else may tell you something else, you know. So I think, you know, making sure that's why ethics works well when it's interdisciplinary, to say, what are all of these things that are going on? We want to make it easy as possible for patients to have advocates with them, and there's somebody watching us all the time. And we want patients to be able to establish websites to keep in touch with their loved ones. And, you know, does that mean someone else is watching us all the time? And so on and on. The diversity that we have, or the idea that our hospitals are open, and it's not two people who get visitors' passes to come in, you know, for 2 hours or something, but you have people sleeping there and bringing food and such, also can add to the sense of tension sometimes. You know, you have a lot of people around, and is somebody going to question when something that is right looks wrong or looks questionable? The sharpest ethics committees that I've observed or been part of bring this up regularly. They don't wait for a crisis to happen. They don't do it as a root cause analysis. They say, so what about the fact that our organizations are more porous now? You know, what about the tension between transparency and privacy? And so, you know, but I think that is hugely important, the idea that more people are watching what you're doing. Absolutely. I mean, I was on a task force recently about a policy, whether healthcare workers should have mandatory seasonal flu vaccinations. And I was part of the task force on that. And I got a call from somebody in a state very far from where I live saying, can you tell me how I can do X in my hospital? And I'm like, how did you find me? Well, she had looked up the proceedings that were part of the full disclosure law and had gotten me. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, wow. So there's a lot of things that are on the public record now. But that's just part of the environment we're in now. I don't think there's an easy answer, but I'm glad you brought it up.
As a chaplain, I can say, the Bible says, guard your heart. And whether they forgive you or not, sometimes it's very hard to forgive ourselves. And sometimes we don't have the power to forgive ourselves. That's when we go to the higher power to say, Lord, forgive me. And help me to forgive myself because I can't. And then peace comes over your heart. But we need the Lord when we cannot do it on our own.
And thank you. And I'm sure as a chaplain, you've also had situations where it would be, without knowing the full dynamics in a family, it would be inappropriate to pressure people to reconcile. You know, one person may have harmed one another grievously, and someone else may be saying, but shouldn't you try to bring them together near death? And you might have to say, that's not something I can do.
It seems like in this country, especially, and when you talk about studies, the context is really important, that when there's harm done to a patient, that might result in need of medical expenses far into the future. Mm-hmm. And so to try to get compensated or to have that expense paid for, it's almost like an adversarial situation has to be set up the mm-hmm. way our legal system, our healthcare mm-hmm. system is in this country. We have to sue to get compensated for that future care, since we do not have a national or a single payer healthcare system. It's easier for the VA, for example, to do to admit to injury because they're going to provide that care into the future forever. So that takes away that incentive to sue to get that care into the future. So I was wondering if you, I believe I've heard about how Sweden, the situation there, they have a national system, but they've set up a national compensation mm-hmm. fund
right.
so that whenever a harm or an injury occurs, immediately the physician who's been involved in that starts helping the patient to access that mm-hmm. fund. We don't have anything like that in this country as well.
We do in a bit. In Sweden, Denmark, New Zealand, and one other Scandinavian country, I think Finland, have no-fault systems. They also have universal healthcare systems, so it's a feature of the system. And in Denmark, I mean, you can go online and fill out your form, and it's all pretty. The idea is we've all paid in, and this is we all sort of get it out. In the United States, as you rightly point out, because we don't have a single-payer healthcare system, we've got a fragmented system. You still do see approaches to this, as Lee mentioned. The University of Michigan system is a very large system that includes the hospitals and also includes a lot of the doctors. So in their approach to risk management focuses on settling claims and trying to avoid litigation. And so they have something like that approach, and they've actually polled the doctors in the system too and have gotten very high satisfaction in saying, it feels like the right thing to do, my premium stayed under control, so they poll patients and they also poll the doctors. But probably the example that gets written up the most is the 3Rs program in Colorado. Which is run by an insurer called COPEC. So they insure both the hospitals, but they also are a MedMal, they insure the doctors. So they have a no-fault program that goes, it's got a cap of like around $30,000. So it's not for very, very large expenses, but it's very, very well thought through. So doctors have to, they receive a lot of communication training, they're partnered with a risk manager. After it's all over, the doctor's the head of the program, calls up the doctor and says, okay, so how are you now? kind of a thing. So that's just, but my understanding is that that hasn't been replicated very much in the insurance industry. But then I always remember, in my book I talk about Catholic Healthcare West, which is now called Dignity Health, a very large system on the West Coast, and they realized that all of their hospitals were never all going to do exactly the same thing. There were just too many of them. But they decided to, they came up with what they called a philosophy of mistake management. And their idea was they took the words that are on the wall in the hospital or on the website, you know, our excellence and stewardship. And they said, well, what do these things mean when we hurt someone that we were trying to help? So to say, what are our first principles? And one of the things they said was, you know, part of our stewardship is using our insurance money responsibly, which means sometimes we use it to compensate people, or sometimes being responsive to patients. Justice means that we will tell them, you should have a lawyer because we have legal counsel. If there was a very big power imbalance in the room, so there are ways that sometimes a system has thought it through. I think one thing that's always problematic is if there's no way for someone to get compensation without filing a lawsuit, it puts one in the category of being a litigant right away. So that's always interesting, is can you actually secure some form of compensation without taking the first step of having to hire a lawyer? Very good question.
I have one question. Well, thank you for a marvelous talk. I have a little question, a statement, and then maybe a little joke. This what I struggle with most is the word forgiveness, and it's kind of difficult to sort of walk around that. Mm-hmm. And you know, I definitely don't see myself asking a patient for forgiveness. I will disclose, and this was my role in this and all that. But to ask forgiveness really dumps it in his lap or her lap, and I don't think that the patient deserves that. They forgive on their own time if they want to. I saw a patient today who's 33 years old, real tough guy, was involved in a gang, and he ended up in the hospital with a bad encephalitis and meningitis, and the doctors knew he was going to die. They just knew it. They told his family. They prepared his family, and is he Catholic? Well, let's call a priest. And so this young priest comes to the bedside. This guy can't talk. He can sort of see. He remembers a few things about what was going on, but he can't talk at all. He's just sort of blah, 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 blah. And trying to talk to this guy, and the priest sees how agitated he is, and he says, you know, don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. It's like being born again. And he just wanted to strangle the guy, you know. Things just get all confused at that point. And so it's more a point about communication at end of life and what really needs to be said, and harm can be done by any member of the medical team.
Right. Well, exactly. It reminds me, there's this, I've done some research projects on chaplains, and they have these funny sayings. They'll say that your job is to get yourself out of the way, like yourself, like not going in there with your script or your agenda. But they'll also say that their job is to sit down and shut up. Because, you know, they're, you know, listening. They're meant to be listening. And something, you know, sometimes people come and they're trying to fill a silence, or they're not quite sure. They don't know what the diagnosis is exactly, and so they extrapolate from something else.
That's true. I think they are at a disadvantage. They're just told to come to the bedside,
right?
And they know nothing about the case, and nobody wants to violate the patient's confidentiality,
right?
So they are at a big disadvantage.
Yeah. So that's something. Some hospitals do try to involve local clergy in, you know, sorts of basic training, you know, if you're going to be at the bedside. But it's hard because their world is very different from a chaplain's world. They're very different from a doctor's world. I remember giving a talk in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where everyone knows everyone, and there's like one rabbi for there's one moil for the whole state. One person does all the brises for the entire state. So, you know, and people were just talking about these very complicated scenarios that they had to get good at, because, you know, they would be called in, you know, here's the person who's the member of this particular denomination and you're the guy, you know, and they were talking about things in a very sophisticated way. And so, that's just probably because you have this community presence here in such an amazing community, might be something to just try out every so often, you know, being prepared to come to the bedside. I have a friend who wrote a book on a clergy guide to end-of-life care, and she said clergy are no different from anyone else in terms of their fear of death. You know, their concerns about mortality. They're not necessarily, they might know about funerals, but they might not know really how to approach a sick person.
We have time for our last question right here. And then after that, we'll thank our speaker, who will then be outside signing books. And if you have any questions that you want to talk to her about, that would be great.
I must identify, I'm a lay person, not a physician nor a caregiver.
Oh, so am I.
I would say it was very important for me to come to this presentation because it surprised me that in a medical school, the doctors and to-be doctors and caregivers would be talking about forgiveness. It is also my belief that it's very important what you guys are talking about. I also believe that the great unwashed masses of us patients would be amazed that you are. Mm. Because there are many, many of us who believe that physicians generally believe they are infallible. And no one really is. Mm. But it is a delight to see this type of education going on. It's a delight to see students and physicians also and caregivers, nurses, attending and discussing forgiveness. It's great for a patient or for a layperson to see that. Thank you.
Well, that's great. That's a wonderful last note. That's terrific. Thank you.